Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the ISCast. This is episode 20, a big landmark for us. We are now in the 20s.
Huzzah.
Yes.
We're only four away from our 2-year anniversary. We'll have to do something special for that. We'll figure out something.
It is August 3rd, and we have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about today. On today's episode, we've got some film, new tech. We're going to be talking about some interesting developments in the film industry, specifically Nolan and other directors fighting back against the studios for the preservation of film. And we're also going to talk about some screenwriting, I guess my personal journey in writing and your guys as well, maybe. And then also some game developments, obviously, as we talk about every month.
Yeah, and those game developments that I see are no longer on our agenda.
Well, they are on mine. Oh. Kicking it off right away. Kicking it off. David brought up the story about a Super 8 camera that was just made. Get this.
Yeah, brand new. And this is really surprising. When people shoot film in Hollywood at this point, they shoot either 35mm, which is a standard film format, or you're shooting like IMAX, which is 70mm. And it's very rare that people use 8mm, though there are certain people that use it. Most recently, the one I'd see in this article, which is on Wired, is Ben Affleck used it for the U.S. Embassy mob scenes in the movie Argo.
Sure.
Yeah, so it's a way of vignetting down. And Spike Lee uses it a bunch as well.
It makes sense for period pieces like that because that's what the cameras back then, those were the ones that were available.
Sure.
So when I think about Super 8, I think about, the movie, the recent Spielberg movie, but also what was used as the home video camera back in the
day. Exactly.
My grandpa had one, and that's how they recorded family events. Mm-hmm. But this was made by who? Who made this camera?
This one is made by a company called Logmar.
Okay.
And what makes this camera special, even among the Super 8, it is Super 8. Amongst cameras, is apparently an issue with older cameras is that older ones, they're not particularly well made. There's a lot of imperfections in them, especially with like the pull down claw,
yep,
where it would cause the film, like there would be jitter or waving in the film, and like it wouldn't come down and seat in the gate properly. And so this one, like they talk about how this is, this has picture stabilization because of it has a fixed pressure plate and precision milled registration pin, which is. No, it's just really well made. And it also, another unique thing is that it does have C-mount lenses. C-mount being, if I remember correctly, the Bolex camera lenses.
Sure. Yep.
So that is interchangeable, which is also unusual for Super 8 cameras.
Yeah, and it looks like a terrific fusion between the traditional film contraption and also a new electronic camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. It's like a black box with a viewfinder and a battery. It looks electronic, but no, it shoots film.
Yep, and yeah, that's what, when I first saw it, I thought, they made a Super 8 digital camera. But
sure.
Yeah, no, it is film. And, it has the built-in, what's it called, video assist. So
okay.
You can see what's coming through the gate.
Yes, and so the quick question, the monitor here, so it does have a traditional viewfinder. Is that a reliable viewfinder? Because I know when you're shooting film, like a Bolex, for example, back in film school, you can't rely on what's coming through the eyepiece. You have to measure precisely your f-stop and your focus distance.
Yeah, no, I would say you probably need, in that respect, you probably still need to treat it as a film camera.
Sure.
And you need to be mindful of that. And the other nice thing that they talk about is that it has really high-quality digital audio recording capabilities built in.
What does it record to?
SD cards.
Interesting.
Yep.
So
the one thing I don't see on here, but I'd be wondering if they may add it, because obviously you see those, so there is a... there's a video assist, so you can see. So I wonder if there's the possibility of recording the video assist feed. Like, I don't think that doesn't replace the quality.
Right.
It's low quality, but I wonder if that would be an option for, like, an interesting artistic choice.
Very interesting.
To shoot with that.
Now, based on its size, it looks like it records maybe, 100-foot reels?
Yeah, I think so, just 100-foot, so 3
where
minutes.
Where is the magazine even?
It's all built into the camera itself.
Oh,
so, yeah, on these kind of cameras, you don't see the blimp. Like you do on when you think of a stereotypical film camera, the big double reels on top. This doesn't have that. It's the Super 8s are built in because they come in these little cartridges.
Hmm.
The film.
And I totally forgot to do this in the beginning. It's myself, Wade, Ben, and David here today. The three of
and
us.
David.
Yes, if you couldn't tell already.
Yep.
Well, that's really interesting. How much does it go for?
This one, apparently, for the first 20 order, it's going to be $3,500, and then after that, the prices will go up to $5,000.
Wow.
So
very interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be I think the people who like it, like as I mentioned, like Spike, what's his face?
Spike Ben Affleck?
Not Ben, Spike Lee. I don't want to say Spike Jones for a minute. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. Spike Lee. I wonder if they're.
I keep saying Ben Affleck. That's how I'm going to call him from now on. Ben Affleck. That's really cool.
Yeah, so I'm curious if, because there's not going to be a really reliable version of the Super 8, if those filmmakers who like it will maybe use it in upcoming projects, or if there are people who don't normally use it, if we'll see that in upcoming projects. So I'm really curious to see where that will go.
Cool. Also in film tech, another fusion of the old and the new is an iPhone app with a little contraption that plugs into the headphone jack.
Yes.
Want to get into that, David?
Yes, I do. It is really interesting, this thing. So it basically...
It's a Kickstarter campaign, right?
Yes, it is. Okay. So imagine, like, you know, like on the top of light meters, there's the white, you know, ball or half circle that covers the light sensor. So this is basically just that part of the light meter, and that plugs into the headphone jack of your phone. And as soon as you plug it in, it brings up your the app automatically. That it, and this is called the Lumu, L-U-M-U. And oh no, I'm sorry, the Kickstarter's finished on this one. So okay, that was last year. They're probably in production at this.
Looks
one.
Like it's going for 99 euros.
Yep. So call it about 125,
150 maybe.
150? Okay, $150.
It always changes.
Yeah. And see, and apparently the review, this is on Cinema 5D, this review, and it gives it, it's a great review. They're saying it's nicely reliable, and I think they were stacking it up against a the Kenco light meter, which is a really standard light meter. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that it matches up really nicely, and it's a very accurate sensor. He's getting about the same readings between the two.
What's the pricing of the comparative one?
The Kenco one is like $350 or so. And so like this one, again, because it's just plugged into your phone, and like it, and what it comes with, which I think is kind of interesting, it comes with like a pendant that you sort of plug it into that you wear as a necklace. That's if you don't have it plugged into your phone.
Do you know if any professionals have used this product yet?
I don't know, but I don't think so. As I said, this is really new. So, you know, we may be seeing more of it amongst independent filmmakers in the coming months, because I suspect if the Kickstarter just wrapped up last year, this is probably the start of their production run.
Cool.
Yeah. And I think it's really cool just because you start seeing this more, that a lot of companies that would normally create like a standalone product like the Comparison
Kenco.
The Kenco, they're leveraging all of the processing power on your smartphone,
which you already have.
So you already buy into the cost already. Mm-hmm. So that allows them to sell you a cheaper item, because you're just paying for like a much smaller hardware cost. Mm-hmm. And then you're just buying software.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And it looks like it's pretty much just like you said, the white half sphere shield, and underneath there's this microprocessor.
And then the sensor.
It looks familiar, and I think that's a big thing.
Yeah. excuse me. And I think, because you know, when we got into the digital world, like when you are able to let the camera deal with more of that processing of figuring out, because you know, like almost every camera nowadays, you can flip to auto, and the camera's processor figures everything out for you.
Right.
But I'm curious.
Well, for the most part.
For the most part. So I'm curious if now it's going to flip back to using a light meter, because I know one thing we're seeing, because we just got our new Blackmagic, which shoots RAW.
Yep.
And I think we have to be mindful of, if we shoot in RAW, the exposure of it, because we have to sort of find the balance point where it's not going to be too bad at one end and too or at the other end.
Yes, correct. So, although the lazy part of me says, no, that's the opposite of what that means, because it's RAW. We can do whatever we want in post.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
Yeah. So I'm curious if as RAW continues to develop and becomes more common, more cameras, if people are going to start to use light meters again.
Sure. It reminds
me to be
me
more
of,
mindful
it reminds
of
me of when I was in film school and the app came out for the Slate. And we were still shooting on film back then with the Arri SR. And yeah, we were using that because the Slate app obviously doesn't need to be as functional as a light meter app. It just needs to clap.
Yep.
But yep. That's really cool. So we've been talking about a fusion of the old and the new, but there's a couple of directors in Hollywood that are all about the old and preserving the old look of our favorite movies. And they want to preserve Kodak make sure that they're still in business so they can shoot their productions on celluloid, which has been dramatically declining in popularity amongst filmmakers. I think according to this chart here, it started around 2010 when it was really dropping, and it's dramatically fell since then, the use of celluloid in major Hollywood productions.
Yeah, let's put it this way. In, 2006 or so, Kodak made 12.8 4 billion with a B feet of film. And then in 2014, they made 449.3 million. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge, huge drop.
Yes.
When it comes to that.
And you know, it's funny because back when digital was still trying to, back just before when the Red One was announced, I think it was announced in 2006, late 06, early 07, I would see all these videos made by Kodak. One of them was the director of Green Day's music video for Boulevard of Broken Dreams, which was shot on film. And I don't know if you guys seen that music video. It has a really interesting look because it was shot on film, and then he just basically took out the film, laid it out, and just like rubbed it in dirt and stepped on it and burned some sections, so it looks really like distraught.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. So he's on this video and he's saying, you know, I feel like the revolution never happened. Like, film is still top dog. And I'm thinking, well, you know, give it time. And then here we are looking at this result. But, you know, despite me being all for progress, it's good to have options. So it's interesting that this is happening.
Yeah, and what I have an article from the LA Times. I'm just citing sources nonstop today.
You are.
Okay,
so we haven't really gone through the who, what, when, where, why of this issue. Want to lead us through?
Yeah, and I just found this article, which is different from the one I originally linked to you guys. And yeah, what it's basically saying is, here's the quote from a chief executive at Kodak. After extensive discussions with filmmakers, leading studios, and others who recognize the unique artistic and archival qualities of film, we intend to continue production. Kodak thanks these industry leaders for their support and ingenuity in finding a way to extend the life of film. And those industry leaders being such people as Christopher Nolan and J.J. Abrams, who are big proponents for film. And so basically what it's seeming like is going to happen is, I think they're trying, because those filmmakers, they really love film and they love the look of film and they want to make sure that they still have the option to shoot on film. Mm-hmm. So I think what the basically is sort of happening is in the companies in Hollywood and whatnot are basically, I think, going to agree to purchase a certain amount of film every year. And then just so that, you know, filmmakers have the option of doing
whether or not it sits on the shelf.
Yeah, I think so. again, I think that was mentioned in the article here that the archival qualities of film are unsurpassed. Like, nothing digital will last as long as film. You know, a CD, your average CD, like your Memorex or whatever, we are not sponsored by Memorex, but off the shelf, has a shelf life of about 5 years after being burned.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas film, they have films, you know, probably from the 30s, 40s, 20s, sitting in a salt mine in Colorado, I think.
When properly stored, yeah, they last a long time. I don't think the lifespan has been fully realized because it hasn't been around that long.
Exactly. And you know, I think looking at it, the people say that at this point we'll always have the ability to read digital files, which I call complete shenanigans on. There are plenty of files that I cannot read anymore.
Like what?
There are old ones from my first laptop, which I got from my grandfather, which was a Toshiba Satellite Pro, like 1612 or something. It's this big old brick. And I don't know what. I'll have to look it up again, and I'll try and get back to you guys. I was using some word processor that he used on there from time to time. And
was it AppleWorks?
It was not. It was a Toshiba, so it was a PC.
Sure.
And it was some special program, and it recorded in, what was it? It was recorded in like DOK files or something. It sort of seemed like a ripoff of Word or something.
Sure.
And I can't read them anymore.
No, and that's a good point. I mean, well, I'm assuming you were wrapping up.
If you put it into a text editor, you could probably read it. It was probably
I'll have to look. I'll see if I have them.
Digital media is entirely reliant on the programs used to read it. I entirely agree. But that's true. I mean, you could say the same for the film. I mean, you need projectors to show film. You need some way to watch it.
But the other thing is, one way or another, you can still look at film. Even if you can hold it up to the light and you can see it, and you can, you know, and you can eventually figure out, you can put a lens on it, whatever. But I mean, you can't hold up a light to a hard drive and see the videos that are stored on it.
Sure.
So there's that.
Yes. Someday there will be chips in our head that let us do this.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so it's interesting. Like, you look at the filmmakers who are demanding, you know, the use of continued use of celluloid, Quentin Tarantino, J.J. Abrams.
Oh, Judd Apatow, I forgot about.
And Chris Nolan. And it's really easy to look at this and kind of root for them because, you know, these are highly esteemed directors who make really good films. What if it was flipped? What if the directors demanding this were like Michael Bay and just like, you know, directors who make less than quality work, in my opinion, as far as like good storytelling, right? Or like, you know what I'm
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, yeah. No, I gotcha.
Would we take it as seriously?
If I'm completely honest, I don't know if I would. I might take them. Yeah, because you know, I look at for that film. You know, it has this artistic quality. And granted, you know, all like lots of movies look great on film, whether the movie is of good quality or not. Like film just looks good.
Sure, that's true.
But yeah, I think it's these guys that are these older filmmakers that appreciate that, and the new ones like you said, like Michael Bay or I don't know, like James Cameron, who are all about pushing forward. And,
I see, and whatnot,
and they want the benefits that they have in digital, and to do what they do. So I'm sure it's a million times easier to do compositing and visual effects like CG and explosions and Ninja Turtles jumping off an exploding building on a movie poster that says 9/11.
To a point, but I feel like if Chris Nolan were here, he would completely object to that and cite Inception as a wonderful fusion, and also yes. Star Trek, the new Star Trek, is a fusion between, you know, film and live action sets and CG and all of those
lens
elements.
Flare.
And lens flare. Lots of lens flare.
That's lots of lens flare.
But my point is,
of course,
is
that's
like,
not a good movie, though.
My point is that, that you know, we trust these directors. We understand that they make quality work, and we trust them to know what's good for their work as an artist and also maybe what's good for film culture as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's expanding too much on that, but do you think that do you think the reason why their work is good is because it's shot on film?
I mean, they might
say yes, but I wonder if... Do we think that their good work is contingent on the existence of film?
Oh, no, not at
film?
All. No.
It's really impossible to say. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the fact that they're shooting on film inspires them to do something different. I have no idea.
Mm. Actually, I would actually say maybe to that, because I do think looking at film... I have noticed in myself. The most recent one I had actually done this with was the recent Hunger Games, which was that Catching Fire.
Yeah.
For that one, I first saw it on digital, in a movie theater, and then obviously in a movie theater. And then about 2 weeks later, and when I was going on a little vacation, I saw it again in a smaller like second run theater. It wasn't second run, but another theater, but it was on film. There and I noticed the difference. I honestly did. There was you could tell the grain in it, and I think that there's a different emotional connection with that. And that may be for me because when I was growing up, everything was film projection. Like there was no such thing as digital. So maybe I have a difference. So maybe if you ask that same question, and you brought say a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old, and sat them and had them watch a movie in digital and had watched in film, maybe they'll have the reversed reaction.
Sure.
Maybe they'll think that the digital looks better to them, and they have a different connection with the digital.
But the grain can also be an artistic choice too, right? So because you can do that, you can mimic that digitally.
You can mimic it, but it's not the same because you can still see the pixels.
Mm.
Obviously, there's more to it than the grain because that's, I think, more... more nostalgia than anything. I mean, you look at people who prefer the scratchy, you know, dusty sound of records to digital MP3s. I wish Sean was here because he would talk about this new media player that Neil Young is coming out with.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Sean,
it's like a triangle, isn't it?
Yeah, and Sean actually pre-ordered it, and he'll be getting it this fall, I think. And what it does is it's a new a music player that plays full lossless music. Exactly how it was intended to be heard. And so when I think about film versus digital, and it makes me think of, you know, old vinyls versus lossless, because digital has, maybe not yet, but has the potential to surpass film as far as like quality of image captured.
Mm.
You know, so maybe the director thinks, I want to show the audience exactly as it looks when I'm standing here on set. And maybe we'll reach a point where film just can't do that and digital can, as it has with music.
Mm.
So a physical medium like vinyl can no longer replicate what this new music player can give us, full lossless audio. And I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because then you can choose to, if you want to make it not lossless, if you want to give it grain or anything like that, you can choose to do that.
I got
to
say, if I ever saw a movie that looks as it does in real life, if you will, as it does on set, mm-hmm. I would probably walk out. Because that would look like a tacky soap opera or something.
Really? No,
well,
I mean,
think about what stuff looks like on film or even in movies in general. Sure. Digital doesn't matter. Like, I went to a Star Trek mini exhibit they had at the Mall of America, and they had a couple of costumes, I think only a couple, that were actually used on set. And if you walked up and look at the costumes, a lot of the costume does not look anything like it does on film.
Okay.
Or on digital. It has a completely different quality to it. You know, like, as something we work on when we're doing armor and stuff for Dawn Under Heaven, it's like there are certain aspects that won't come across when we film it.
Sure.
Things that sort of, if you will, get sort of fudged in that recording process of mm-hmm. taking the image onto a sensor. And so, like, you know, if I saw it as it was, like, I feel like that whole experience would become like, oh, I'm watching someone's home movie.
Don't you think that just pushes the people who are doing the production design and, like, costumes and wardrobes to, like, up their game to make it more
That's not my point.
Makes it more expensive, at least.
That's not my point about... I'm just talking about how, like, the fact that it doesn't come across one-to-one is a good thing. Like it's like when you watch a soap opera. If you watch a soap opera, it looks like you pulled out your iPhone sometimes, and it has that look to it, that soap opera look.
I understand. So do you think that films that are trying to become more one-to-one, like let's say a 48 frames per second 3D film, do you think that's bad? That's a step in the wrong direction because it's trying to come across more that way?
I would not say that it is bad. I would say that it is different.
Okay.
Is what I would say. Because I saw now the only two films I know of that were projected in 48 was the two Hobbit movies that are out so far. I did see that in 48 in 3D. And it didn't bother me at all in that.
You had to get used to it first.
Yes, you had to get used to it. You know, it's like switching from 60 hertz to 120 hertz
right.
on your TV. It didn't bother me, though. Like, I don't know if I would ever see myself, for example, filming in 48 frames per second.
Except that GoPro scene in The Hobbit 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, not a scene, just a shot.
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
Right. Well, okay. Okay. Well, I honestly would be really excited to see if something like that happened in film. So we were trying to all see Guardians of the Galaxy this month. Unfortunately, it just came out the other day, so you two didn't get the chance to see it.
Sorry, guys.
Sean, Lee, and I saw it, but only I am here, unfortunately, today.
So let's have a Wade Wojcik split personality discussion.
Oh, sure. The first thing I wanted to say was that I saw it in 3D, and you know, I was really against 3D when it first started coming out mainstream in the theaters. And as I'm sitting there in the theater the other day watching this movie, you know, I find myself kind of like going back and forth between the glasses to see the difference. And you know what? I think I'm reaching a point now with where it's justifiable in a lot of action movies, but maybe just in general, because when watching a simple dialogue scene, the fact that there's depth, right? More depth in people's faces and the environment actually made it feel more immersive. And I think I finally reached that tipping point as a viewer.
That's interesting. I do want to see this, and it's been getting lots of great reviews, and so I'm going to try and see it, hopefully, within the next couple
of weeks.
I'm not
talking about the quality of the movie. I'm just talking about...
I gotcha. it's gotten good reviews. I will say at this point, the number of movies, and like more recently, like for me, it really has been like the Hobbit movies are the ones I've seen in 3D, mainly because I wanted to see them in 48, because I've been very curious about that choice. You know, for me personally, I'm still nowhere near that point. Like for me, like 3D still seemed like just a big gimmick and a way to add another $8 to the ticket price.
But do you think it's justifiable in certain films that are more experienced films, like Gravity?
I think 3D has a place. Though I think there needs to be the balance point between making use of 3D for what it can do and for what I would call fan service moments, which I don't like, which is someone reaches out at the screen towards your face to grab something or whatever. Like those kind of moments, I don't like. Sometimes they can be what I would call tastefully done, where it's sort of it's not a, it's sort of own moment. Like I'm trying to think, what are some of the ones?
Well, that there was a good moment.
A yes or no would do, David.
Nah. Maybe. My gut says maybe.
Sure. So.
So I think there is a place for 3D. I do not think it is everywhere.
Okay.
I don't think it's been around long enough for people to really kind of get the nuances of it yet, or to really use it.
To be fair, 3D has been around for like 50 years.
Well, no, the good kind of 3D, right? The one that they started doing.
Well,
the last
decade. There was an old version of 3D that was actually pretty close to what it is now.
You're talking about with the red and blue glasses?
No, there was a different one that was where you had two projectors that had to go at the same time, and they basically they're almost doing the exact same thing, where you know the because it splits the image, it'd be to give it the depth, and your glasses redo it. There was an old film form of 3D that did that.
Sure. So going back to the movie, you guys obviously saw the trailer, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, they've been doing quite the marketing.
Before I talk about what I thought, and I'll keep spoilers out because you know we haven't seen it or you haven't seen it.
Well, we don't talk about spoilers on the podcast.
We did actually, I think, last month.
Yeah, we do. If all of us see it, we end up doing it.
Oh, we should avoid that.
Well,
move on.
Neither here nor there.
No.
So based on the trailer, what do you guys think? Do you think you would enjoy it? Do you think it would jive with you? What do you?
I think it was interesting to see the various trailers as they come out with CGI changing. I thought that was interesting.
Hmm. Interesting. I did notice that.
Are you guys familiar with the story? Did you know about this before the trailer?
No.
Okay.
No, but I've done my share of research.
I'm interested in it. I think Chris Pratt is kind of coming into his own, and I'm kind of excited to see him doing more and more things. It looks fun. I want to go see it. It'd be cool.
David, what, do you think you'd enjoy it? Mr. Cynic Critic,
yes. I can say I would probably enjoy it in the same way that I have enjoyed other superhero films in recent times. Not all of them, but most of them.
Okay.
Where it is entertainment, and that's about it. I'm not going to go to this to have I don't know how to say it. Like an eye-opening experience, when you go into you go into some films and you walk out, thinking about the world differently, like Inception or whatever. Walk into that and then you're open to a different perspective on the way of looking at things and how you go through. There's a theme that comes across and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I do not go into superhero movies to find that.
Well, I don't think they're made with the intention to inspire people.
Yeah, if you watched the trailer and thought you were going to get that, you're a fool.
that's what I'm saying. So that's what I'm going with most superhero movies. Like I, at this point, am pretty sick of superhero movies. They have been, riding this cash cow. And, Marvel has announced its release dates for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Not what is being released, but they announced that something is going to be released on the following dates. I think they did that at Comic-Con. Oh, yeah, Comic-Con just happened.
Yeah.
We should talk about that. There's not a whole lot of movies I have any interest in seeing. Like, I probably won't see Batman versus Superman. I don't really care about what are some of the other ones that are coming out? I don't remember.
We'll have to strike those from our podcast watching then.
If we want to see it, we'll have to find
the very narrow beam of movies that.
I would like to see more movies that are made with the intention to inspire. Because I feel like the movies that I have to go to see to find that are like Christopher Nolan movies, and he's the only person I can rely on.
Sure. So we'll talk about later. About
guys, just sticking with Guardians for a minute before we meander too far. you guys. Obviously, we get the point that it's not going to be cinema gold. It's not going to, inspire meaningful metaphysical discussion or anything, because it's a superhero movie, it's an action movie, it's a summer action movie, and
third highest grossing of the year.
And so take a movie like this is a classic example I like to cite, Pirates of the Caribbean. Obviously just summer fun, but that is a really good movie. It's one of my favorite movies.
Talking about the first one,
of course.
Yeah, no, not the later ones.
Yeah, no.
But what I'm wondering is, like, movies like that obviously have value. Like, I'm assuming you guys like that movie as well.
Yes.
So just because it's pure entertainment and not, and not trying to get at deeper human issues doesn't mean it's a bad movie. And it can also be one of your favorite.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's not a reason to get on this movie's case.
Well, I'm not getting on it. I'm just saying that that's... that's what my thoughts on it are. Like, that's what kind of movie it is.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't think it's going to be any more than that, but I'm not saying it's going to be bad.
But the tone was, you know, it's not going to be, like, anything great, but it's entertainment. Whereas if I was talking about Pirates, I'd be like, you know what? It was damn fun to watch. You know, it's all about the tone, David. You gotta work on that tone. You got the cynic critic tone.
Yeah, I know.
But having said that, you know, I don't know if I agree with the 91% review on Rotten Tomatoes, the Metascore.
Didn't like it? Or you didn't like it that much?
The thing is, it didn't click with me. I felt like it was trying to be way too funny than it actually was. And they were trying to have, you know, dramatic moments that we were meant to care about, but it didn't build a foundation with the characters to build off that. They would have these ridiculous comic relief moments, like right after or right before moments that were supposed to be really sad or serious, and we're meant to take it seriously when there's no reason to. You know, the characters are, for the most part, not fleshed out enough to care with what happens.
Yeah.
And the movie is floated with cliches about like something happening at just the right moment, at just the right time to save them. To a point where all tension is dissolved, and I actually feel like nothing bad can happen because they're always going to get rescued at the right time because the writer knew that that's what other better movies have done, so I'm going to do it. But that said, there are a lot of fun moments. There are a lot of cool things that they do. The visuals are really cool. And, you know, they do nods to other parts of the Marvel Universe, like the Tesseract.
Yeah, I will say that Marvel has been doing a fantastic job about interconnecting these films in a meaningful way, but not an overbearing way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like you saw Iron Man fly by or anything, but yeah, like you mentioned the Tesseract, and I think from what I said, there's a character that shows up. I don't want to name who he or she is. There's a character that shows up in here in this movie that has been in like the after credit scenes some other movies.
Yeah.
And so they do a really great job of interconnecting that in a good, meaningful way.
So just for a brief setup, it's not, I don't know, it's in the beginning, so I don't know if it's spoilers.
No.
Okay.
And there's plenty of information about
this. So basically, the beginning scene is a very heart-wrenching scene where the main character is watching his mother with cancer die. That's in the very beginning of the movie.
Right.
Within 5 minutes, she dies, and then he runs outside and instantly gets abducted by aliens, and that's the beginning.
Yeah.
And then we cut to 26 years later, and there's absolutely no explanation for that or what was happening or what he, you know, it's just not even addressed, and it's slightly mentioned at the very end, but for me, that didn't work because the whole time I'm wondering, well, what the hell? Like, why did this happen? And he makes no, like, during the whole movie, the Chris Pratt character, the main character, Star-Lord, he makes no effort to either say he tried to get back to Earth to connect with his family again or, like, go home at all. He was just like, yeah, no, I'm in space now. I'm with other aliens. It's cool.
Do you think that this is more just because Marvel accepts that the majority of people already know?
Yeah, and I think that's what they relied too heavily on. They relied far too heavily on people knowing their mythology for this story. Because another example, there's this huge alien society called the Xandar. The Xandarians?
Yeah, kind of a cheesy name.
I don't know who they are. I don't know. And the villain, Ronan, he, in the very beginning, says, your culture is like a disease and I want to wipe it from the galaxy or something. I don't know what the Xandarian culture is. From what I can tell, they look exactly like human. They behave exactly like American humans. They live in a city that looks like the starbase at Star Trek. It looks exactly like Earth. It's John C. Reilly is one of the Xandarian guards. It's like, oh, yeah, no, they're human. And they keep referring to Chris Pratt's character as a Terra. It's like, well, how are they different? You know, give me the who, what, when, where, why of this story so it can make sense of it.
And, well, it's also interesting, though. I would disagree with you, Ben, about your comment about people knowing the mythology, because this is one of the lesser... It's not like what I would call the lower tier of the Marvel universe of things.
You wouldn't call it the bottom of the barrel?
No. It's sort of in the middle. So it's a popular one, but obviously it's nowhere near Iron Man, the Hulk, all that kind of stuff, the Avengers.
I'm fine with that. I just want to know what's happening in the movie.
Yeah. Well, and the other interesting thing is I was reading an article about some of the main characters from Guardians of the Galaxy and how far some of them have deviated from all their comic book basis. Because that sort of, the origin story of Star-Lord, Peter Quill. I don't remember his first name.
Yeah, Quill. Yeah, yeah. No, that's his name.
That is nothing like how it is in the comics.
Huh.
It's completely different. And I don't want to say what that is. If you care to look it up, you can. I don't want to say it because it does spoil aspects that may come up in later movies for the Guardians.
Well, anyway, that was my take. I enjoyed it, but I found it profoundly confusing and in a way that it shouldn't have been. Hmm. At least for a person who had no idea about any Guardian of the Galaxy anything. But I don't know. It had some fun moments. I see people like raving about it and like it was the best Marvel movie ever.
Oh, I did not share that, and I would grossly disagree.
And
with that.
I don't know. I thought about like joining in on the internet discussion about how I wanted to be critical of it, but I would see other people critical of it, and people would just ream. I'm like, no, you're just a hater. It was the best movie. I'm like, I'm avoiding that like the plague.
Yeah, that happened to me about the pocket camera.
But anyway,
talk about that later.
I would, you know. It's still fun summer movie if you guys want to go see it.
Do you just think that's because the other people went in there with more of the intention to I want entertainment versus like I'm going to look for I want to get
clarity.
Well, I want to get into the setting. I want to understand the character. Like maybe they don't want to be as invested in the characters as they just want to see something cool.
Probably. It's just so weird to me to see people like Philip DeFranco say I haven't walked out of a theater with this big a smile on my face in a long time, and it's like, how did this movie connect with people?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I rolled my eyes so many times during it because it's like, no, I've seen this scene before in a better movie.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Well, and I also have to agree with you because one thing that I love in movies and in video games that I love when there's an immersive universe created that has a lot of mythology to it. Not, I don't mean like actual mythology, like fake stories, but you know, there's substance to the universe. There's backstories to things, and obviously you can't discuss every backstory to every aspect of a universe in a movie. But I like it when they at least make reference to it, so you get an idea of what that backstory of something is, and then you know whether that's explored in other content or something else, or you're just left to like explore it in your own mind of where it could go.
Sure.
I like when it immerses you in that way, like. You know, like, you know, some video games are coming out.
Yeah.
I think it's, like, a little difficult to achieve. I mean, how difficult is it to achieve that in 2 hours, though, as a screenwriter? You know, like...
Sure. Which you know, moves into the next topic here.
Classy.
We were gonna talk about. Yes, very classy. So, guys, one of the things we do as filmmakers is make our own content. And, you know, whether or not... we had any training in screenwriting. And eventually, some of us are going to have to do some writing to actually, you know, film something. And David, you took writing classes in school? Or no? Did they not have it at Augsburg?
No, they did. I didn't take it because of my concentration.
Okay. So I had a few semesters of screenwriting class. But what I find interesting is, you know, screenwriting is a completely different beast from writing novels or
yeah.
For anything else. It's I find it profoundly difficult. And over the years, you know, my writing's changed, and there are a lot of great online resources that have helped me be more critical of my work, but also, you know, you can tell I'm critical of other people's work, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. And there you guys might have seen some of these. The biggest one that I reference online is redlettermedia.com.
Yeah, they're really great.
And they're known predominantly for their critique of the Star Wars prequels. And that's how a lot of people found them online, because up till then there hadn't really been like an in-depth look at why the prequels are bad movies.
Yeah.
But what's funny is up till I saw that review, I thought, you know, the prequels are they're okay. They're not terrible films. But then, you know, going through that review, Mike, the main guy, he breaks down everything that's wrong with it, from the Phantom Menace having no clear protagonist and then he goes into the Attack of the Clones and talking about how what Anakin does to try and woo Padme should never work and would never work on any woman.
No.
He does like one or two things right and then all these things wrong, like creepy sex looks and like condescending tone and all this stuff. And then the third movie, which I thought was the best of the three, but there's quite a lot of things that shouldn't have been the way they were.
Yeah. It has the least wrong of it in a lot of wrong things.
Exactly.
Is the way to put it.
But no, it's just like watching those, it made me think, you know what? There was so much in the writing that could have been altered to make it a much more enjoyable film, let alone if the special effects were bad or the acting. But the writing itself could have improved. So that's one that I watch a lot. They also have a web series called Half in the Bag, where they just basically talk about, you know, a movie at a time that's come out in the theaters. Just so I can get their opinion. we don't always agree, but I think they have a lot of valid points. For example, they didn't like Into Darkness at all, the second new Star Trek film.
Oh, I agree with them on that.
Well, they didn't talk about the warp core like you did.
Okay. But there was other stuff wrong with it, too.
But another one is CinemaSins. That's also on YouTube. And they basically say everything that's wrong with blank in so many minutes. And that one's great because even if it's a movie I haven't seen, like Dragon Ball, I can still watch it and see all the stupid things that were in the script that shouldn't have been.
Yeah. My one issue with them is that they always count coincidences in there.
Oh,
and
sure.
And for me, like, yes, like, there is a point, like, I think you were saying with Guardians of the Galaxy, where coincidences, like, where things happen to work out, there's a point where you can go too far.
Yes.
But when you look at it, like, every movie is coincidences.
Right.
Because if any one thing had happened differently, the movie wouldn't happen.
But, like, a coincidence is good as far as creating conflict, but a coincidence as far as getting people out of conflict feels like cheating.
Not always. But it depends on their. It depends. You know,
it can go too far. But that's, I think, where it is. Anyway.
Another thing that he does is continuity errors, which I don't know. It doesn't bother me quite as much because that's not in the writing. That's just in
There's also just we're only human.
Right. And like I think I was telling you guys, I was watching the movie Gladiator while reading the script to kind of get that experience. And in the opening scene where the Roman army is fighting the Germans. There's a shot where the Germans are bashing their shields and like trying to egg the Roman army on when they haven't opened fired yet, and they've got a bunch of arrows sticking on their shields and like all around them. It's like, wait, this is out of order. They haven't even opened fired yet.
Yeah.
Continuity errors, you know, they're kind of, you know, they can take you out a little bit, but they're not a huge error. Anyway, so CinemaSins talks about, okay, so Dragon Ball, for example, just watching that, like, you can see just in black and white in front of you all the different cliches that are put in. To me it seems because writers see good movies, they see movies they like, they see elements that are in the movies they like. For example, like the prophecy, right? In Dragon Ball there's a prophecy, but it's just like out of nowhere. But but I would think that the writer said, oh, movies with prophecies are cool, and my movie should be cool, so I need to have a prophecy. Or another thing about Dragon Ball that's funny is the main character protagonist is this, you know, normal American white guy who has a Asian grandfather.
Yeah.
Who's teaching him all the moves.
Hayukan.
Yeah, but...
Wrong film.
Yeah.
Wrong franchise, I should say.
So, you know, it's funny because for anyone who's tried writing in general or maybe screenwriting, it's really easy to see when you step back and look at it where your flaws are. Like, for example, if you write cliches or if you write in lines, lines that are a little too on the nose, right? So when I was in writing class, we talked about how dialogue and action together, you know, need to have degrees of subtlety because the audience needs to be engaged in what they're watching. If you put everything on the nose, which is just basically upfront, then it's boring. There's no degree of mystery or subtlety to it. Like, I was talking to you guys about the first draft of Gladiator. Ridley Scott thought the dialogue was too on the nose, so we had it redoctored by a different writer. Because, especially in a movie that you want, like a really well-written movie, you want that subtlety in the dialogue. You want characters to not always say what they're thinking, to try and manipulate a situation. And that's interesting, because that makes people feel more real. If you have people say exactly what they're thinking, because you want to progress the plot, then, you know, audiences can typically see right through your ploy as a writer.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I haven't done a whole lot of screenwriting in quite a while now. I'm probably going to get back into it for another show that's being developed, that we're developing. If it's interesting to look at, my writing was awful. I'll just say it how it is. Like,
everyone's is when they start.
Yeah. Well, you know, like when I was writing, because I was writing almost every, I think it was actually almost all the shorts that Intersection did starting out when we started doing when we put out a bunch of shorts, that was before, before you started on Wade. When Ben was in almost every one of the shorts, I was writing most of those, and they're really all, they got, I think, a little bit better over time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell, like, and with me, like, all I see whenever I do any work is I only see the flaws with it and all the problems.
Well, that's no reason to stop. You just kind of
Not at all. Yeah, no, you know, other things happen that cause me
You're
not to
You're just very critical of yourself, though.
I am. But yeah, I'm trying to think of, you know, some of the really awful like one-liners and stuff. Like the one that, oddly enough, is one of the highest viewed shorts that we did.
Which was our, that?
Which was Not Today, which was interesting because that was our one drama short.
Oh yeah,
that was and it was weird because, you know, looking at it, like it was pretty poorly written. Like that one, it was the basic premise was the main character got a letter that told him. Well, he got a letter. You don't know what's on the letter, but he got a letter. And then he goes through his day, and you can tell something's off with him the whole time. And, you know, with really cheesy dialogue that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And, you know, in the very end, you find out that... Well, I'll spoil this because this has been out for years.
Oh, I will say Vertical has 3 more views than Not Today.
Oh, finally. That's good.
No, good.
But technically, our most viewed short or whatever was the teaser, the prelude.
Oh yeah, yeah.
10,000 or 11,000.
Yeah, that's wonderful. But you know, you find at the end that this character's parents died in a car crash. Which he found out in a letter. In hindsight, it shouldn't have been a letter. It should have been a phone call.
Yes.
But well, that's neither here nor there. but you know, looking at that, and you know, it's interesting with that one, which I consider one of the more, you know, relatively poorly written one there. And now I'm curious, as I said, I'm going to start going back into a little bit of it, you know, in a couple of months or so, that I'm going to be curious where that dynamic has shifted. Granted, what I will be writing won't necessarily be drama or that, but...
And part of the reason of the success of that screenplay, was that you didn't leave the mystery there. Is that you don't, the audience doesn't know what the contents of that letter is. They don't know what's causing the grief of the protagonist or the character. So the audience becomes invested into what's happening, what's going on.
Sure.
Which relates back to what you were saying.
And yeah, and that's a great example. Like if you, and it's not a for sure thing. That's where the art comes in. You really got to play with degrees of mystery. You can't. But I think that in that sense, it did work. Yeah. So, you know, one tough thing when writing is pulling inspiration out of the content that you like, that movies we like, or just your everyday experience. One of the exercises that we had to do in class was have a little black book, and whenever we'd see something, like if we'd be people watching and we'd see an interesting person, they had like an interesting like outfit or just some kind of interaction, we'd have to write it down in our black book, and then every week we would jot down like a one-page description of things we would see. And that way, when you're writing a scene or you're looking for ideas, you go back to your book and you pull from that. Mm-hmm. But also another great source of inspiration we were talking about is video games, because working on a Halo fan film, that's a huge source to be tapped. And speaking of Halo, which I just brought up.
Well done.
I can do my own segues. So Ridley Scott has been working on a project called Halo Nightfall, which is to lead up to Halo 5 next year. And this is to introduce the new character, Agent Locke.
With an E.
Yes. so there, was it the teaser trailer, I think?
Teaser trailer, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was just dropped a little while back. And, you know, it looks pretty cool. It has definitely an Alien Prometheus vibe to it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I agree with some of the design choices on the armor.
Yeah.
Specifically the ODST.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's Microsoft. They can do what they want to do. But I will say this. I think we can all agree that the best ODST designs were Bungie's.
Oh, easily.
And why wouldn't you want to... I know you want to do your own thing, Microsoft, but use the best material. Use the mm-hmm. coolest looking stuff, but whatever. Actually, they did. In Forward Unto Dawn, the older brother of the protagonist, he was wearing the same armor that they used for We Are ODST.
Oh yeah,
that was the coolest ODST armor I thought. But
that was also my favorite marketing.
Oh yeah,
was that ODST?
Oh, it's
one.
Everyone's favorite.
Yeah,
to this
so
day.
Good.
But well,
there's a lot of people like the Halo 3 one because there was that whole live action landfall.
Oh yeah.
So
yes.
Anyway,
yes.
But anyway, that was a cool one too.
That wasn't really a trailer though. That was like a marketing thing.
Well, the We Are ODST was a marketing thing.
No, it was a trailer.
No, it was a marketing thing. It was really? A commercial for ODST.
Yeah, but it wasn't. Oh, it wasn't about the storyline itself.
Sorry. Yeah, yes. It was a commercial, but Landfall wasn't a commercial.
Right. So I don't know. Are there any more details on that?
Nothing. It's coming out in November, I think.
Okay.
Is when we have to coincide.
Yeah, and it's being released on Xbox. So like people, if you have an Xbox One or an Xbox 360, you get to watch it.
Yes.
Yeah, and also if you get the Master Chief Collection. It's coming bundled with that. And I also heard rumor that the Master Chief Collection is only going to be $60.
Which I'm impressed about.
Because it's
shocked.
Four games.
It's four full games. Yeah. With one of them being completely remastered.
Yes.
Is
it coming with the remastered version of Halo 1?
I think so.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder what Halo 3 is going to look like.
Well, compared to Halo 2, it's going to look like crap at this point.
Well, I mean, obviously, they're not going to remake it to the extent they remade Halo 2, but, you know, it's coming out for the Xbox One, so it's got to look better, right?
No. They haven't remastered Halo 3 or Halo 4. I would imagine that they probably will remaster Halo 3, just not yet.
That's weird to come out with this bundle before remastering 3. Well,
I wonder if they're going to set it up.
2 years.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to set it up as, like, a DLC kind of thing. So, like, in another two years, if you have the Master... If you have the Master Collection, you can buy the remastered version, add it to your collection.
Sure. And also there's a thing where I think they're like when they remastered Halo 1, they added the terminal stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that they're adding that stuff into Halo 2.
They are. There
and whatnot. In a way that is also going to lead into Halo 5.
Okay.
I think it's like it's pushing it in that way as well. Like I don't know if it's like I don't think it's gonna be directly into Halo 5, but there's going to be allusions to it.
Watch the
episode. Like there was in Halo 1, I think there was allusions in that one to Halo 4 when they remastered it. There was talk about Prometheans and whatnot in some of those terminals.
I wonder if the Arbiter is going to show up in Halo 5.
Oh, he definitely will.
Ooh,
oh, yeah, he was in the trailer. He's going to show up.
No, he was in his own trailer. He wasn't in the trailer for Halo 5.
Well, that trailer was for Halo 5, about Halo 5.
No, it was for the terminals in Halo 2.
Well, I think it's safe to say, because the Arbiter is shown talking to Agent Locke. So yeah. I think it's safe to say he will appear.
Yeah.
Do you remember that trailer?
Maybe I didn't see that.
Really? We were raving about it.
Yeah.
It was all over the internet. Yeah. Basically, the Arbiter is talking to Agent Locke while you're seeing the cutscene from Halo 2 where Master Chief's bringing the Covenant bomb off the platform.
Okay, maybe I misinterpreted that.
And then Locke is wearing his full armor. So at the time, we didn't know if he was human or not, but now we know it is. So also, Halo might be out of the hands of Bungie, but Bungie is still busy with their beta for their new game, Destiny, which I didn't get to try. I was sadly too busy, but you two got to play it.
Yeah,
I got to play it, and so it was for a week, basically? Or I had a three-day window, basically, to play it, because I have a Xbox 360. So I played it in the first 2 days. I had a total blast. I enjoyed it a lot more. Like, in all honesty, based on some of the newer stuff coming out about it, my expectations were going down a bit because I didn't know how much I was going to enjoy the gameplay. Mm-hmm. And then I played, it was awesome, and then got to that third day, and betas end in the midnight range or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I get home at like 6 or 7 o'clock, and like, yes, I can play Destiny for like 4 more hours, and it was already dead.
Oh. Yeah, they ended it early. Yeah, it was really kind of sad.
It was going to be awesome because the time difference is in our favor, so I would have been able to play till 2 a.m.
So, guys, overall impressions so far of the game?
It's not going to be as iconic as Halo was. Because Halo has that main character, Master Chief. Master Chief can become an icon.
Yes.
Whereas Destiny, the player is the hero,
sure,
more or less. I think that it will be as big as Halo, but I don't think it will have as much of a lasting... I think its impression will be more like Star Wars. It's like, how Star Wars has like a setting, like, and everybody loves being in that setting and returning to that setting.
Yeah.
I think that Bungie has set it up to be like Star Wars and have that longevity.
So you think that it's not going to be as iconic as Halo, but as iconic as Star Wars?
Because Star Wars is iconic in
the
setting.
Do you think Star Wars is less iconic than Halo?
No, it's iconic differently.
Okay. So, okay. That's confusing.
That's fine. Yeah, you worded that poorly.
Probably.
Let's see. I'm trying to find some of the stats and the infographics. So over the course of it, there were 6.5 million Guardians created. At one time during the very end, they had the special, or on Saturday, they had the special moon mission they unlocked for that for a couple hours. And for that, there was 853,235 Guardians playing at the same time.
Wow.
Let me see.
I think that was a record-breaking thing for a beta.
Yeah, it was. Let's see. What are some of the other things? I'm trying to read a low-res picture. there were... Wait, players?
A lot of players.
There's a lot of players.
A lot of people did it.
And there were apparently 1,959 people who didn't go to the moon but lied about going there.
Really?
Yeah, that's what the stat
right.
is.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, and that I think Destiny is doing a great job with what. Well, I love where they chose to set Destiny, like in the ruins of a golden age. So you're basically you're re-exploring stuff that, you know, the humans had already been there.
Yeah. Well, even your character was a part of the golden age.
Yes.
No spoilers.
You learn it within the first couple of minutes that you are resurrected.
Do I know it right now? Then it's a spoiler.
Well, there it goes.
And like what I was talking about earlier, where there's this mythology, there's this universe to explore and learn more about. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. I hope there. I didn't get a sense, like, I feel like there were questions I had that didn't have any answers yet. And there didn't seem like any clear-cut way to find the answers.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, I'm sure there's going to be more when the game actually launches.
So there's a lot of setting stuff that if you look in the companion app, which is also really awesome that they created.
Oh, I forgot about that.
There's a grim, what they call the grimoire, and it has a whole bunch of like small little tidbits. And if you get more lore if you actually look into all the descriptions of the items that you pick up. So there's a lot of lore that's kind of littered around the game, and it's there if you want to go find it, but it's not cool. It's not in the way if you don't want to care about it.
Sweet.
Okay, that's interesting. I'll explore that more. That sounds fun.
Yeah, so we're gonna have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much for tuning into the IsCast, where we are at the intersection of all things video games.
I see what you did there.
Film, music, tech, and all that glory. We'll see you guys next time. Thanks.